Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 339 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 16th of September, 2017, as I record this. And there's definitely a chill in the air as autumn is actually here in Bath. And it's funny because we were away. I kind of missed the first fall of what we call conkers or horse chestnuts, and it's a part of the year I really love, and I go around collecting them, and you know, I kind of missed the first rush and that loads of them were gone because we were away in Italy, and I was quite upset, but I did find a few, so that was exciting. I always sort of mark that in the calendar, first conquer of the year. Anyway, today I'm talking with Ros Morris about writing memoir. Now, Ros has been on the show a number of times because she's always a popular guest and we enjoy talking about various things, and this time we're talking about her latest book, Not Quite Lost, a quirky little memoir that I actually really like a lot and will, well, certainly intend to use as a kind of model for when I finally get around to writing a memoir myself. So even if you're not writing memoir, we have an interesting talk about authenticity and the line between sharing personal stories and, you know, personal stories that will help and entertain others versus writing for therapy. And I definitely write for therapy. You know, when I went through a divorce a number of years ago now, a long time ago now, actually, since Jonathan and I have been happily married for a long time. you know, certainly when I went through that, I wrote a ton of stuff, which I don't even recognize as me anymore. And that was definitely therapy. So, but what's interesting is how in a memoir or even in social media, you know, there are things that we share and things that we keep private. So what, when to publish, when to share openly. For example, many of you have said that the show I did, one with Sarah Painter on worrying, and also the one where I shared my ups and downs of the prize ceremony, ITW, and my fears as an author, and you know, all of that, that you find when I share personally, that really helps. But obviously, you know, I also have a role in the community and hopefully in your life as a listener as a positive voice. So I'm not going to share when I'm really down and depressed, which doesn't happen very often. But anyway, with Ros, we talk about some of these different dichotomies of writing, and yeah, I found it really interesting. So I hope you do too. So, yeah, nothing really caught my eye in publishing or futurist stuff this week. Some people have asked me to talk about various aspects of publishing news, but I would point you at the sellmorebookshow.com, the Sellmore Bookshow podcast, which does a weekly publishing news show. And my aim is not to be a news show, but to talk about things in a bigger perspective, I guess, when I find things interesting, and nothing really stood out. So I'm going to move straight on to my personal update this week, because I did post my lessons learned from 6 years as an author entrepreneur, because it is my 6 year anniversary since I left my day job in September 2011. And what I've done every year since is I've posted, you know, lessons learned from 1 year, 2 years, etc. And what I've also done is round up my journey, because I've realized recently, and people comment like, oh, well, what can you, you know, what have you got to share with someone who's just started writing? And I always get a little bit upset about that because I think I still have a lot to share. But I realize that what you see now, like the Joanna Penn now, is very different to the Joanna Penn from, you know, 2006, when I first started writing with the intent of publication, and even my first novel in sort of 2011, 2012. So I've got a roundup page at thecreativepen.com/timeline. And on that page, I go all the way from sort of 2006 to where I am now. And I've linked all of my annual lessons learned, and also some sort of big milestones along the way. So when I started, you know, when I published, you know, book for the first time, when I hit some lists, you know, I even had a look and I actually started Twitter in January 2009. I started the podcast in March 2009, so it was quite a big year for me, 2009. I also started writing fiction 2009. So anyway, you can go to thecreativepen.com/timeline to have a look through that, so that you can see the journey of an author from no books to lots of books, to multi six figures. So, but this week I'm going to talk about my lessons learned from 6 years. And why it's interesting to do this every year is, like, the first year, the lessons year from year one were things like how you adapt from a day job to running your own life, and the difficulty I had with, you know, not having a commute and being alone all the time, even though I'm an introvert. And, you know, that I don't struggle with that anymore, but it's great to have that written down as something that I went through that first year. And I know many people do struggle with that if they move to writing full time. But this year, I have a couple of things. So first of all, more co-writing means more books and helps more people. So I am not a book a month type person. That's just not me. I can do a couple a year, but I am not a book a month. So I'm never going to write that, but I have so many ideas. And this year I've actually done a lot more co-writing. So I started co-writing sort of 2015 when Jay Thorne and I did Risen Gods. And, you know, I'm trying to do more, but this year I've done American Demon Hunters, which I did on the train with Jay, Zach and Lindsay Broker. And Jay and Zach are now running more trips on the train, which is kind of awesome. But doing that, I learned a lot about creativity, about how other people work, and it was just fascinating in so many ways. I'm also co-writing with my mum, which I've talked about before, and we are now on our third co-written book together. So that's pretty exciting. I'm also, the book I'm actually working on right now is The Healthy Writer, which I'm co-writing with Ewan Lawson, who is a medical doctor. And I was almost crying this week, actually, because I did a survey, which many of you joined in. We had nearly 1,100 responses to the survey about, you know, the healthy writer and physical pain. And some of the stories are just heartbreaking. So I'm really positive about this book. I think this book is going to help a lot of people. And I'm really sort of sharing my pain lessons and my thoughts on things like dictation and yoga and a lot of, you know, talking a lot about the things I've been through, headaches, migraines, mental health. So I'm really hoping this book will help. But I couldn't and wouldn't write a book called The Healthy Writer on my own. It has to really be with a co-writer. So with you, and it's going to be awesome. So that's kind of one thing. And then, you know, maybe that will help you by thinking, how can you use co-writing or collaboration to reach more readers, help more people and make more money? So thinking about someone like Michael Anderle, who's been on many podcasts, not been on this one yet, hopefully will be next year. And also, you know, doing a lot of co-writing and ramping up an author business that way. Joseph Alexander, who does it with nonfiction, he is coming on the podcast pretty soon. And obviously Steve Scott's been on the podcast, you know, people who, and Sean, Johnny, Dave have all been on the podcast, who co-write together full time. So this is the thing. I think co-writing is magic. And as indies, we have much more ability to do this. And if you're struggling, you know, one of the most painful thing is the split of the money, but you can use something like Bundle Rabbit to manage the payment side. And Chuck was on the show back in May this year, talking about bundling and also using the payment splitter with Bundle Rabbit to do co-writing. So there is a solution now. So there's no reason why authors can't sort of get on with co-writing. The second thing is embrace the continued demand for print. So in the last year, I started Curl Up Press, you know, a small press to actually do the print books. I've done, you know, started working with Ingram Spark, who are actually going to be a sponsor on the podcast as well. You know, I only work with companies who I use and personally recommend. And Ingram Spark has been brilliant for expanding my print distribution. So really happy about that. You know, I mentioned mentioned the Dean Wesley Smith post on the value of a paperback, which is fantastic, and really sort of doubling down on doing print. I'm still doing print on demand. I did look earlier this year at doing a print run with a company like Clay's, who do, you know, like a small print run, but just didn't really see the profit in that. I've obviously also moved to using Vellum for my ebook publishing, and just really sort of, you know, the one of the basic things about being an indie is the actual publishing tasks, and, you know, taking it more seriously with a small press is interesting. I also recently I've done a print edition of Successful Self-Publishing, which many of you have asked for. It has been an ebook only for a while, but I used Vellum to format that and used KDP print as the distribution mechanism. So it's really interesting. I've also done a large print edition of one of the romances because I've noticed there's been a demand for that. And yeah, so really interesting to start playing with more ideas around print. And I fully expect to do more on that. I'm actually next week going to the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild in the UK. I'm going to their autumn conference. So hopefully share some tips from that next week. But yeah, kind of changing my mindset to be more than just an indie author, but also to be a press. Haven't focused at all on any rights licensing. We've changed direction a lot with what we're doing, sort of with what Jonathan's doing. So yeah, I'm not really looking at that right now, but it's definitely good to have books on Ingram Spark. And you don't need a small press to do that, but you do need your own ISBNs. Okay, then my third thing was focus on what really matters. Don't create another job. Say no more. And I have to learn this so often. I'm such a people pleaser, and people email me and they're like, can you do this or do that? And I'm like, yes, yes, of course. And of course, I want to help people and I want to have relationships with you guys and my community, but it becomes unsustainable if email or social media overwhelms me and burns me out. And you guys know this. This is a common issue in the indie author community, but social media in general can burn you out with comparisonitis, and there's always something you should be doing. And I'm trying to revisit sort of why I wanted to do this, and I, you know, wanted a life of freedom, not another job. And I do work more hours than I ever did in my day job, and that's fine because I love what I do. But I have now been doing this full time for 6 years, and it's time that I started, you know, really honing down on what I want to do. So, for example, I want to do 6 weeks on the Camino de Santiago, which is a trip I've wanted to do for many years, probably about 15 years now. I've been talking about doing the Camino and haven't done it. And I realized, you know, we did a week in Italy and I couldn't even step away from the business for a week. And, you know, like with you guys. And I thought, you know, well, what about the podcast over 6 weeks? Or, you know, and then it's like, okay, well, actually, I could just say to you, right, I'm taking 2 months away. I'll be back in 8 weeks' time. Please don't unsubscribe. See you then. I mean, I could do that, but I've kind of locked my mind into things and I need to start changing that. So I'm definitely not giving up the podcast, but there isn't a reason I can't take a little break. So anyway, I'm thinking about this a lot more, what I could eliminate or outsource, and also what is really unique about what I offer the world. So let's face it, you know, back when I started the Creative Pen in 2008, there weren't many people blogging and podcasting about self-publishing. I was one of the very first people in the space outside of the sort of speaker market. You know, there were always people self-publishing as speakers, but there weren't many people in this sort of indie niche. And then with the Kindle, it became a thing. But now there's so much information on self-publishing. So I need to really look at where I sit within the market and the unique things that make me. And again, everything I share, I hope you're thinking about your life. But basically what other people cannot replicate is fiction as JF Penn. You know, when I write my own fiction as JF Penn, no one else can write the books I write as JF Penn. No one else can write the same things I do, because that's me. And also my nonfiction as Joanna Penn, even though there might be other books on, you know, things like my author mindset or how to make a living with your writing, it's my spin on it. So my books and your books cannot be replicated by anyone else. And also this podcast. No one else, even though there are lots of other podcasts, you're listening to this and probably other ones, but you're listening to this one because you resonate with my story and that's uniquely me. So I need, you know, these are the two, like literally the two things I came up with are my books and this podcast. Everything else can be done by other people. Any basic how-to stuff can be done by other people. But the opinions and the thoughts and the personal journey and the authenticity is us. And, you know, just a little bit of futurist stuff. If you think that AIs will, I mean, AIs are already doing a lot of nonfiction journalism, and I bet you they're doing nonfiction books, and they will start writing fiction. I'm sure that there's been an AI-generated Game of Thrones book. There's been an album that a musician has done with an AI. You know, there's Centaur Chess, which is when an AI and a chess master work together. You know, we will be using AIs in this environment within a couple of years, or, you know, let's say 5 years, certainly 10 years, probably before then. So what will stand out? The only thing that stands out is your voice and your personality and you, and building a personal brand around you. So I think that's really important. And the book I keep recommending on this is Deep Work by Cal Newport. Really looking at what you can focus on and what is uniquely you, what is worth your time overall. And then finally, and I know, sorry, this is going on a bit, but many of you have said that you enjoy my introductions, and it's my show, so fast forward if you don't like this. But the final thing is investing for longer term streams of income. So, and the reason I share this is because when you first start writing, and many of you may be on your first book or first books, or, you know, making a couple of £100 a month or dollars a month, or, you know, maybe a few thousand, but, and those first few years are definitely lean. They are for sure very lean. But, you know, I've been full-time for 6 years, running the website for 9 years, coming up to 9 years now, and this business for nearly 11 years. And the money, as I've shared before, you know, in 2015 overtook what I used to earn. And if you are persistent and productive, the work, the money you can make as a writer, podcaster, speaker, author, entrepreneur can overtake your day job income and be more than you need to live on. And so what, you know, we're very fortunate, and I'm very grateful to you guys and to everyone who contributes to my author, entrepreneur business, that we can now start to look at investments. So in the same way that a book is an asset that can earn money for you over time, in the same way, money itself can be an asset that earns money for you over time with investments. And so now we're covering our sort of our living costs and all of that. We're looking at, okay, so what do we do? Again, so I'm not dependent on me, because what happens if I get sick? Or for Jonathan, you know, what happens if something happens to me and I can't work or I disappear? And don't worry, I do have, you know, plans in place for if something does happen to me, you will know about it. But this is the thing, you know, you have to kind of consider, all right, well, how do I protect the people I love, the life I love, and also have an author income or another stream of income that's not dependent on my creative output or physical presence. So investments are something I'm looking at. And again, I think this is something that you only start looking at when you're making enough money that you cover all your daily stuff. But the two books I recommend if you're interested are Unshakable by Tony Robbins, which I think is excellent, very American focused, but still useful wherever you live. And also How to Own the World by Andrew Craig, which is UK focused. So that's interesting. But again, both of those books can be read by anyone in any country and applied to your situation. Okay, so that's my lessons learned for the last year. And thank you for joining me as I head into year 7 or as an author entrepreneur. And check out thecreativepen.com/timeline if you want to have a look at, you know, the whole journey from 2006 to 2017. and onwards. Let us move onwards together. Okay, right. How are we doing? Okay, right. So, yes, the seasons are changing. And I also wanted to kind of mention that I feel very happy and positive, and the illness that I had over the last few weeks really made me quite negative and, depleted in energy and difficulty. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of reflect on the cycles of energy as the seasons change, just being gentle with ourselves. And especially if you're coming into the winter, at the moment, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, you would have just come out of that. Hopefully you're ramping up. But it's interesting. Right now, there's a kind of move towards Christmas, this kind of positive, and then it's all going to die down a bit as the winter comes. So, refinding your mojo, if you've lost it a bit, a refocus as we come into the last sort of third of the year, quarter of the year. Let's see what we can achieve between now and Christmas. As part of my positive energy shift, I have booked for the Isle of Wight Challenge. I've mentioned this before, so I am now the type of person who does ultra marathons. I've done three, which is anything over a marathon, essentially. And I have booked, along with a group of writers, some of you are joining me, to walk 104 kilometres in a weekend, May 2018. If you go to isleofwightchallenge.com, White spelled W-I-G-H-T, if you are not British, but the Isle of Wight is an island off our south coast. Or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. If you want to get the information about our team, you can always join us in May 2018. Also, in terms of speaking stuff, I'll be at the Society of Authors in Scotland next weekend. Then I'll be in Oregon for the Coast Business Workshop with Dean Wesley-Smith, Christine Catherine Rush, and also Youpreneur, Chris Ducker's event in London in November, where Pat Flynn from Smart Passive Income and John Lee Dumas are also speaking. So I've got lots that I'm doing in the next sort of quarter, but I'm also going to some conferences rather than speaking. So if you're interested, I'll be at How to Create Anything by Orna Ross. And of course, Orna is a creativity mentor for me as well as a friend. And she's one of those people who can really spark big shifts in you. And she's doing a full day in London, 25th of November. If you go to Eventbrite and search for Orna Ross, it will come up. I'll put a link in the show notes, so I'll be there. I'll also be at the 20 Books to 50K London event in February 2018, which is at 20bookslondon.com. And many of you will know the Facebook group and what Michael Anderley and Craig Martell are doing. And I'm really fascinated by this kind of new wave of indies, because as I said about my timeline, let's face it, I'm one of the old school. and I started self-publishing before even the Kindle was introduced. So there you go. Right. I also wanted to mention a useful podcast from the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Marketing Podcast this week, or last week it was, with Lindsay Barocca, Jeff and Joe, talking about 12 ways to keep your backlist selling and maintain a steady income. Things like running a sale, doing ads on book one, doing box sets, relaunches, like Brian Cohen has recently done with the superhero series. And you can listen to the Sell More Book Show about that. Print giveaways on Goodreads, which I'm doing every week now, talking about print focus, a few minutes ago. I'm sort of rolling through my books over time, keeping a constant stream of new eyes on my books for quite a small return, let's face it. And after Dean Wesley-Smith's post about the longevity of paperbacks in the market over time, I like having print books out there doing their thing with a kind of serendipitous slant, I guess. So check that out at marketingsff.com, episode 148, or I will link to it in the show notes. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Matthew David Bruff says, I've self-published a few of my own titles. Now I've published my mum's historical novel titled The Prussian Captain. She has just turned 73 and this is her debut, a dream come true for her. Matthew has discovered a lot of this stuff through the podcast. So I'm really thrilled about that. Of course, I'm thrilled when anybody publishes, but I'm you know, like I've said with my mum, I'm particularly happy when people who are later in life and have maybe put off what they want to do and are now getting to it. So awesome. Zornica Ivanova, which is just a wonderful name, Zornica, says, thank you for the great podcast and books. Recently, I published my first book and it was like you were there every step of the way. Thank you, Zornica. And I'm thrilled about that. Lisa M. Lilly, cooking vegetable fried rice, listening to the show with Michael Ridpath. Looks very yummy. Lisa. Breezy Mulligan says, listening to the show while doing Kit Fox telemetry in literally the middle of nowhere, the Carrizo Plains or Carrizo Plains, California. Sent a wonderful picture, but I don't know what Kit Fox telemetry is. So very cool, Breezy. Excellent stuff. Tracy Barnhart says, tired of watching Irma pour down on us in Charleston, taking a break on the spin bike with the podcast. And yes, everyone dealing with flooding and power cuts. Hope you get it all back soon. Kate Armstrong, really enjoyed today's podcast with Michael Ridpath. I think it was my favourite one yet. Very cool. And finally, Kendra Temple says, I just started reading Desecration. You aren't exaggerating when you say your fiction is dark. I love it. Thanks, Kendra. I'm always happy when people check out the dark side. JF Penn, my dark side. Right, today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course. Is it your dream to write a novel, but you just don't know where to start? Have you started writing only to run out of ideas? Are you suffering from self-doubt about whether you're good enough to write a novel? Do you feel overwhelmed by all the information and craft books out there? If you've answered yes to any of these questions, this course might be for you. One course member, Holly S., said, in 6 months, this course has taken my writing further than 6 years of self-teaching. Joanna's positive attitude and teaching style make learning how to write a novel enjoyable and feasible. This is not university writing class fluff. She gives you real tools that will lead you to writing a novel that satisfies readers and tackles the mindset issue and helps writers conquer their inner writing demons. This course is great for people who are starting their writing journey and people who have been writing for years, but something feels off with their manuscripts. Purchasing this course is money well spent. Thank you, Holly S. And the course has videos and audios and slides, so you can do it at your own pace. And there's a private Facebook group where you can ask me any questions. Find out more at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. Okay, so this kind of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription. And in fact, just a little note on that, my hosting bill was double last month what it's been. And I was like, oh my goodness, what's happened? And it was because some of you asked me, I can't remember if I told you guys this, but it was because people were saying, can I put more on the feed? So I upped my feed from, I think it was at 40 episodes, and now it's at 150 episodes. So thank you everyone who downloaded loads of extra episodes. And yeah, my hosting bill was just absolutely huge last month. But yes, thank you for all the sponsorship and Patreon and everything that helps pay for it. So my time in producing this show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Alison Bueller, Frankie Johnny, Dina Byrne, John A. Hodder, and Paul Sating or Satting. I really appreciate your Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can support me with just a couple of dollars, coffee a month or a couple of coffees a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio. And I just yesterday sent out the September Q&A show. So you would have got that if you are a Patreon supporter. And I'm also now including a list of the topics covered so you can check that before listening. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here again with Roz Morris. Hi, Roz.
Hi, Joanna.
Welcome back on the show. So just a little introduction if you've missed one of the many episodes Roz has been on before. Roz is a best-selling author as a ghostwriter and now an award-nominated author with her own literary novels, My Memories of a Future Life and Life Form 3. She writes writing craft books for authors under the Nail Your Novel brand. And her latest book, and the one we're talking about today, is Not Quite Lost, Travels Without a Sense of Direction, which is fantastic. And I've read it myself, which I can't say that with all my guests. But I think I've actually read all your books, Roz. That must be a record.
Well, maybe I don't have very many.
But no, that's fantastic. So because you've been on the show before, we're going to suggest people listen to previous episodes for your history, and we're going to get straight into it and start with definitions. So let's start with, you know, what is the difference between a memoir and a biography?
Well, biographies tend to be written about other people, not by the person who is actually being featured. But the difference between a memoir and an autobiography, you write your own, or someone will ghost it for you, but then that's a whole different world. But generally, an autobiography tends to be an entire life. So it's usually written by somebody who's a very prominent, so famous that you just know their name, and just their name would get you interested, really. The whole thing about them is interesting. But a memoir is much more focused. So one person might have many memoirs in them according to different phases of their lives, different challenges they've faced. People would be interested in them for different things. Another interesting thing about memoir is it often dovetails with other genres. So you might have, there's quite a genre of medical and recovery kinds of stories. So someone might write a memoir about overcoming cancer or being with a friend in the sort of their final years or something like that. And it's just a few years, it's just a short period, and the arc is defined by this experience. Other kinds of memoirs are travel and particular adventures in, say, unusual places, or going around Ireland with a fridge, some of them might be really tiny, appear to be really tiny territories, like Ian Sinclair, who did a book about walking around the M25. They can be big or small, but they tend to be very contained. And I suppose another quite prominent genre is disastrous businesses. So, you know, where you've got a story arc, and the story and the subject is probably going to invite people in, it might be a good idea to consider making it a memoir.
Wow, so much there. And we're going to come back to all these in more detail. But let's come to you now. So why did you decide to write a memoir now at this point, and maybe dovetail in there a bit about what you're writing for your literary stuff right now? And, you know, because it's interesting because obviously your books are literary, so they take longer to write. And this has kind of appeared in the middle of what of writing. So talk about your, like, why now?
Well, it's all sort of happened quite naturally and by accident with no particular plan. Basically, I have a book that, and I've got it right here.
Oh, show us.
It's a leather bound diary. It's an old visitor's book. I don't know if you can see it there. It's got visitors on it. It's leather. It's really tatty. I won't try and open it. It's got gold edging. It's beautiful. And that always traveled in my suitcase. Whenever Dave, my husband, and I went anywhere, that book was in the bag, and we'd unpack it on the first night, and he didn't write in it, I did, but I just liked it as a special book I would use to write in whenever I was a visitor, the visitor's book. And so we were on holiday last November. We just went off to stay in a sweet little folly that it overlooked a river in Nottinghamshire. And I opened the book, and there were some stories in there of things that had happened to us. Like, there was a time when the car window got stuck down, or there was a strange guy that we met who showed us around the sights of Glastonbury and drove us through the hills and said, "Look at that hill, it's the goddess," and things like that. And I'd written all these things down. So first night we got wine, and I said, "Oh, there's this and this and this." And Dave said, you should put those in a book. And I said, yes, yes, they'll go in a novel sometime, because, you know, I've got heaps of notebooks of things, and I sort of dip into them and find things that will be useful for my fiction. But he said, no, I mean, write them as a kind of Bill Bryson sort of journal. And I said, don't be ridiculous. I'm not Bill Bryson. Nobody will take any notice of a little book like that by me. But he thought it was a really good idea. He kept on at me all through the week. And I actually started to like the idea, because I'd so enjoyed writing them for myself. And this is how all our creative work starts anyway, isn't it? We do something that just sort of pleases us. We can lose hours in it. It feels rewarding to do. And we've then sort of discovered how to get a bit better at it and so on. And I'd got these pieces that I'd written because I wanted to keep them and I wanted to make something out of them. So eventually we got back and I thought, all right, well, I will see if I can make a proper book out of it. And I also tried to get various blunt-speaking writer friends to talk me out of it and said, look, this could be very self-indulgent. And they said, no, do it. We think it sounds like a really good idea. So I thought, all right, so I should take this seriously. So I started looking at it and I thought, well, I'll look at the pieces that would be the kinds of things that I would tell other people that might be interesting anecdotes. And then I thought, well, I'll sort of look a bit deeper and see if there are themes I can use to pull it together. And gradually these pieces kind of emerged. It was like planets forming from little bits of asteroid being attracted to a central idea. And in some ways I felt like it was a bit like an album of songs. They weren't necessarily, some of them are stories and some of them are more kind of musings about being in a place. There was one piece that I wrote which was about the first time we had sat nav, because it seemed wondrous, because we were driving in our car and a voice would tell us where to go and it could see us, and it had a little display that said 8 satellites are watching you. And I thought, but that is fantastic. And so I thought, right, I have to see if I can write something that will get other people as excited about that as I was. And that was part of the kind of travel experience that I enjoy. It's little surprising things about life and odd things that I just didn't want to disappear. And that was the book.
Yeah, but I'm still interested in how it fits into what you're currently writing as a novelist, because I find, you know, it's fiction and nonfiction are kind of slightly different. But with memoir, you are bringing in things that I would expect normally to appear in fiction, and like you said, fictionalized in some way. So how did you manage the creative process working on two books? And did you find any sort of cross contamination between the two during the process?
Well, interestingly, I found when I went back over this diary, I found the seeds of various important things that I've put in my fiction. And I hadn't realized that's where they came from. That these experiences had gone into my subconscious somewhere, or you know, maybe the process of writing about them and studying them a bit more meant they became things I then wanted to use in my fiction. For instance, there's a piece about an old house, a mansion in Devon, that now it's mostly overgrown gardens and mysterious steps in the grass, and there's a chunk of tower covered in ivy, and that's about all there is left. And I remember reading about this and discovering it and sort of visiting what I could of it and thinking, this is great. Well, imagine what it was like when it was actually here. And that became the environment of Lifeform 3, which is set in a future when all the countryside has disappeared, except for one estate that used to be a country house like Downton Abbey. And there are little pieces of the house that remain hidden in the woods. And you just find a little corner of stone or a chunk of brick or a fireplace or something. And that idea, I realise, came from my fascination with this house that I discovered and I've visited what I could of it. So there are ways in which these sort of fascinations stay with us and then creep out again as a place we can inhabit or use. And obviously, when you're travelling about or anywhere in life, actually, you might come across people who are going to be posting themselves into your characters. But I think characters are a bit different because I've never made a fictional character directly from someone I've met. I've always done a lot of work and added things to them. So it's more places and environments and sort of maybe chance happenings that I find tend to go into the fiction. And they probably also tend to correspond to just what I'm interested in. I love ideas of haunting, but in non-paranormal ways. So outlines of old buildings, people seeing places as powerful, but in maybe a psychological way rather than a paranormal way. That's why I called it Not Quite Lost in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the title Not Quite Lost came, first of all, as a wry joke on the fact that I have no sense of direction and that these were little tales. So they were just little, there's like columns, you just go about and find one interesting thing and then another interesting thing. But also underneath that was a kind of resonance, an idea of things passing and getting hidden and buried under time. So what I did in this book was I just took my general outlook, the filter that makes fiction, and I put the raw material in the book instead.
No, I think that's really interesting. And I think one of the biggest issues with memoir is what to leave out. And it seems to me, you know, I've read quite a lot of memoir, a lot of travel memoir, and I've read a few at the same time as I was looking at yours. And that was really interesting to see, you know, what people put in and what people don't put in. So, for example, you mentioned yours are vignettes over what, like 25 years or something? The amount of time, and you don't have a bridging thing between each vignette. It's just like this happened and then another time this happened. So you've left out the rest of your life and included these segments of theme that fit around your theme. So when, you know, talking to people listening who want to write their memoir, how do you know what to leave out?
It's a very good question. And the original draft of this was bigger. And then there were things I found that were repeating. And I thought, I don't need to repeat these things. I'll gather together. There's one piece which is called Nobody Comes Here in November. And it's about just being in places out of season. And they're not necessarily friendly environments for tourists anymore. Mm. But if you come at a different time of year, they are. And those took place over several years, actually, and in different places. So I just put them together and thought, right, there's where I deal with that. And then we're not going to visit that again. With a memoir, which might be a story, you know, so if, say, you've got a recovery from something or, you know, coming to terms with something, you'll probably have certain points in an arc, one arc that you will identify. So beginning, middle and end, really, the structure that we put on fictional stories is very useful for writing memoir. And it helps to actually use quite a lot of the fictional techniques. So when I've worked with people who've written memoir, what I've often found is if they identify where these high points are, the various structure points and plot points, and then figure out how they're going to make everything else serve those points and serve that arc and help the reader understand, it's always much easier for them to then see what they can leave out. Mm. And also you have to be willing to reorder events, because emphasis is very important with memoir. It's what an event means. And in fact, you could use an event in a number of different ways, just as you could in a work of fiction. You could use it to illustrate someone's character at the beginning. You could use it as a kind of bit of light relief just after something that's been quite a negative note. You could use it even as a climax. So you need to think of ways that you'll use the raw material you've got. And you often end up leaving a lot out. You often have a lot of darlings. But what I will say to people is that with the internet and with the need to have extra materials, all the stuff you take out can be like DVD extras or little teaser pieces that you can use while getting people involved in the book and seeing if they want to buy it. But yes, you will have a huge wealth of material, and you need to find ways to massage it and make the best use of it, and less is usually more.
Mm. And do you, like, you obviously you have your book there, the visitor's book.
Do you want to look at it again?
Yes, share us again. Lovely, beautiful. And that's great because it kind of gives you your theme. I mean, it just gave you it. I think a lot of people would come to memoir in a more of a different way. So theme for you was obvious. What tips do you have for people if they need to find their theme in a mass of material? Like behind me, I've got a ton of journals. How would I know how to find a theme in there? Or is that something that you think comes to all memoir writers?
I think it does jump out quite obviously. If you, well, actually, and I do know people who have started writing a memoir, but not realised that it's best to be focused on one particular story. So it's like, this is the story of how I did this. Mm. And if you think of it in those terms, then it becomes quite obvious what you'll put in and what you'll leave out for perhaps another book entirely. Mm. In your case, for instance, you've got several sort of episodes to your the big memoirs of Joanna altogether would probably be the publishing journey. Before that, I know you've said in the past that you've run businesses that didn't go terribly well. So you could have the unfortunate business experiences memoirs. You could have a number of things. So if you think of your life in terms of adventures, then that's a way to identify what should go in and what could be left for another kind of book.
Mm. And you mentioned there reordering and also some of the fiction techniques. So how much is absolute truth and how much is storyfied or narrative non-fiction, which some people really hate the idea? You know, when is it fiction and when is it memoir? Is there really a line there?
Well, I think it has to be self-imposed. There are probably a lot of people who get away with writing things as memoirs and they've made stuff up. Mm. But I decided that my own rule, because I do write fiction as well, I thought my own rule had to be it's true. Everything's true. What I have changed is people so that they're not recognisable, unless I've got their permission to put them in. Mm. But otherwise, the people are hopefully not identifiable. But the events are all true, because this was the point of the exercise. I had to make it things that I could get other people interested in, and part of that would be the way I handled the material. Mm. So that often came down actually to telling a joke against myself about, you know, maybe how useless I've been about foreign languages. There's one piece called Pardon Our French, which is just about the kind of pickles that both Dave and I got into, because although we are really good at English, put us in a foreign country where we have to use some other language and we are helpless. And I found this incredibly funny because I thought that it just illustrated how you can take a fish out of water and it is completely useless. So all that, though, it was all truth. What I had to do was find a thing to make out of it. And again, there were quite a few pieces that I tried and I couldn't find the way to make them work. So I just discreetly withdrew them and they have gone back in the book. Maybe they'll end up in fiction.
Yeah. So is the guideline is it should be like 90% truth in order to stay memoir? You know, like it just seems like some people do. Well, your description of, say, the tumble down building, and, you know, adding, if there wasn't any ivy on it, it would be nice if there was some ivy on it, because that, you know, that's what people expect from a tower. Would you have embellished the ivy or some, you know, other stuff like that to kind of make it more atmospheric or other things like that?
I'm trying to think if I did do things like that. That's how genuinely did have ivy on it, and I've got the pictures to prove it.
I believe you.
It was like a big square of ivy. It was all together ivy beard. It was amazing. But I think what I did was I tried to go back to the truth as much as possible, but I might have had to remind myself of things. So I went and looked at a lot of current pictures and thought, oh, yes, I do remember there's a little lane that went up there and it had this feel to it. I think you have to do a lot of reminding. Mm. But I it was just my own personal boundaries. I had to make sure absolutely everything was true and real, and that when I was describing people, even though they weren't going to be recognizable, I was being true to the person in another way. Because what I find with fiction is, because I can make up absolutely anything I like, then that is a completely different department.
Coming to people then, because this is, I think, one of the biggest issues of memoir is many people write about a painful family experience, for example. And of course, you've mentioned Dave, and he's in the book, your husband, Dave. But you also have some stuff about your family, which I didn't know, you know, an estranged family situation and your brother. And so there's obviously sensitive things that must have come up for you, or maybe you've dealt with that. But in reading it, it's kind of like, oh, it's a little glimpse into something that's more intimate than an ivy covered tower, for example. So first of all, from your perspective, how difficult is it to deal with personal things out loud in a memoir?
It is quite difficult. When I first had the idea that I must write that piece, I was kind of 50% collywobbles and 50% eager to do it, because I thought, can I write something that will deal with this and in a way that that will be interesting, you know, of any interest at all to other people for a start, and that also will be fair to everybody involved. And it's not even, it's not that revealing, actually. It doesn't dig any dirt. But it was writing about a time that was, and a situation that was very difficult. So I had to work very hard on that piece and find a way to do justice to it and make it something that stood up in its own right as well. It is hard, but I was reading a lot of personal essays at the time. And I love that as a form. I love the way someone can really kind of open themselves up to the page. They will write about something like, say, a person they had a relationship with, or just one conversation they had. And in that, you feel you've seen them in an incredibly honest place. And I love that. And once I got the idea, well, I must just try to do that with this piece. Forget about anyone who might read it. Do justice to the material first and try and create something that does communicate something that seems to like it would be sort of give to other people. And that's what I did. But I often find with my fiction that in order to write that with truth, I have to sort of think what characters might feel in sort of quite deep and nasty recesses of yourself. And I know you've talked about this, about how you write something and you find, oh, I'm actually delving into some stuff here. People don't necessarily have to think it's me, but I know I'm drawing on something that I understand and maybe have never talked about out loud. So it's a similar sort of thing. But I think that's something that writers do. We plumb ourselves.
No, I think you're right. And I don't think you've done this, but because you're a very wise writer, but I do know that people who might not have as much experience as you, whose first book might be a memoir, I think there is a danger of therapy, you know, a memoir as therapy. So how do people know where that line is between, as you said, sharing something of truth that will help others versus writing for therapy that might be better left in a journal?
Oh, that is so difficult. And it's probably better if you feel there's something that you've just got to discharge, write it as therapy, write with the doors closed, and then let it rest and come out and think, okay, how could this accommodate readers? Because often when you write as therapy, people actually write in a big tunnel and they don't think of how they're coming across and how they're building up other people's understanding of a situation. So they might sort of launch in and they know everything, but the reader doesn't. So they've got to think of how to bring people in, and it takes a lot of practice. And the best thing to do is to read other books that have done that successfully, so you can then spot how they've used the material, how they've brought the reader in, how they've let the reader understand how they felt and kept the reader on their side even when they've done dreadful things. Often these books involve confessions of things that people are actually quite disturbed by or even ashamed by, or they wish they could have done better, all those kinds of things. It is possible to make a memoir out of that material, but it takes a lot of work. And the splurge draft, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, but just the gush where you just get it out is just one phase. And some people don't move beyond that, and that's fine, because therapy is something that is useful. And writing as sort of self-understanding is also useful. But if you're writing it to share with a book-buying audience, that's when you have to start really thinking about how to meet that audience.
Yeah, it's a good point. And yeah, out of my lots and lots of journals, about three of them were when I got divorced, you know, my sort of personal period in my life. And yeah, the woman who wrote those journals, you know, did therapy through writing. And I don't think they're ever worth publishing, or, you know, but it's interesting how sometimes not everything needs to go in a book. At least in an obvious way. And yes, to everyone listening, we're absolutely saying writing as therapy is brilliant. It just doesn't mean it has to be published in some form. Okay, so that's very cool. So I want to ask about staying on the people, the final part of people and truth. Many people worry about getting sued by someone who they might have used in a memoir, because, of course, subjective truth is very different depending on which side of the coin you might have been on. So do you have any tips for people if they're worried about any legal ramifications and they don't want to ask permission? So they don't want to ask the person's permission, and they, you know, say it is a divorce and they want to write something that, you know, has that other person in. You know, do you have any tips for dealing with that?
Well, try and make them completely unrecognizable. And that might be extremely difficult if it's a divorce, because divorces involve big networks of people. Yeah. And everyone knows who they were. And anyone could come out of the woodwork and say, oh, you wrote about me here. And it's really, really difficult. Usually, if a book's being published by a mainstream publisher, and they'll have chosen to take on some of the legal risk, and they'll have a lawyer look through it and so on, and they'll have editors who are used to dealing with this kind of material. As indies, it's a bit more difficult. You might have to get a lawyer to look over it, and that might be money well spent. It all depends on how on what your story is, really. If the story is focusing a lot more on you and what you did and what you kind of learned and how you changed, you might not have to worry about it so much, because really the joke's on you. You probably won't be using other people, painting other people in a bad light. But again, you should be quite careful. I've again worked with quite a few people who've written memoirs, and they've put people together to make a character who represents several. Sometimes that's worked. You just have to be careful. There was a situation in Not Quite Lost where I actually I contacted some people and said, do you mind? And some of them said, oh yeah, and that's absolutely fine. I said, well, you can look at it if you want. They said, no, it's great. And those are the people in the dance advert. The cryonicists, I contacted them and they were sort of quite worried. So I sent them the piece and they wrote back and said, oh, this is a bit iffy. I'm happy to change anything that is not sort of factually correct. So that's fine. But you always have to be careful about things like libel. And libel is bringing somebody into disrepute. And even if you can prove they were an absolute rotter, it is still quite a headache. So you have to be careful. And my final word on this is that some people will find themselves in your book, even if you were never anywhere near them. I read an essay by Caroline Leavitt, who was recently on my series, The Undercover Soundtrack, and she said she got sued over a couple of her novels, actually. There were people, these were novels, they were fiction. Mm-hmm. A couple of people wrote to her publisher and said, you've used my situation and put me in the book. And she said, well, but I can prove I've never heard of you. And unfortunately, it did sort of get to the stage where lawyers were being talked to. So bear in mind that that's the environment you publish into, you, so you do have to be extremely careful.
Mm. Yes. So basically, we're not lawyers, and disclaimer, but yeah, be careful what you're writing and consider how it might affect other people. And again, I think that's where the therapy issue bleeds a little bit, because if you are so hurt by something, and I'm saying this because I've met, whenever I meet someone who's writing a memoir, this, they're always saying something about some very, very volatile situation that sounds like they need therapy rather than to write a book to entertain other people. So that's kind of why I bring it up, because that does seem quite a common reason. Like, anger is a very big reason to write memoir.
Yeah, writing in a state of hurt, writing in a state of injustice, any of this that might be another side of the story. But yeah, you have your right to tell your story, you have your right to figure out your feelings and to use whatever you need to do that. And sometimes it might be better to use it for a novel instead.
Yes, that's what I think. Okay, so I do want to ask you, you mentioned the dance a commercial chapter, which is really interesting. I didn't find it so interesting for the dancing as your comments on imposter syndrome, because you're just like, yeah, I'm not a professional dancer and I'm ending up in this with all these professional people. And you talked about, yeah, feeling like an imposter, fear of being exposed as a fraud. And I thought, you know, this actually, when I was thinking, well, part of me has always wanted to write memoir, and then I think, oh no, I'm not famous. I'm how could I write a memoir? So how did you must have felt that too, right? Like you said, I'm not Bill Bryson, so how can I write something like this? So how did you get over that in order to tackle that imposter syndrome?
Well, it's funny, I think there are two departments to my kind of writer brain, and maybe this is how everybody's imposter syndrome works. There's, you know, at the beginning of this book, for instance, I was thinking, oh, I can't write that. Don't be silly. People like me don't write books like that, or people don't read books like that by people like me. And then enough people said, well, of course you could write something like that. I'd read it, sort of thing. But then still, that's just a small group of friends. But then there's kind of another part, as a sort of more sort of confident part of me, I think. This is only how I work, but maybe other people do too. But I'd find that if I was reading a book like that, I'd think, I'd enjoy writing this kind of thing. And actually, I think I might be all right at it. And then I'd find, you know, you kind of read a few pieces, a few columns by someone who is writing the same kind of thing, and you think, oh yeah, I can just imagine how my piece on such and such would go. And it's like you find if you have a go, you might be able to hit a groove. And that's what I found with Not Quite Lost. I find it's a bit different with my novels, because what tends to happen with my novels is I get an idea and then the hard work starts. And I think, oh, what have I bitten off? Really? I mean, because I tend to do different things each time, it was very easy if I was writing ghostwriting a series, because it would just be, oh yeah, okay, I know exactly where I am. It's a kind of familiar environment, familiar people and everything. But with each novel, it's just a big sort of starting block to get over. And I would think, I don't know if I can do this. And it was exactly what I found I was feeling when I did the dance advert. I thought back over my experiences doing that, I thought, this is what I'm always like. This is me realizing I always feel like an imposter when I start something, that I'm sort of a bit makes me a bit worried that I don't know if I can pull off. And then I find I get into it and that I've sort of fought a few fires and it's still all right. It's still going to just about be workable. I just kind of find my feet, and certainly with writing, I can trust the process. The process has got me through my books, and so when it's going badly, I just think, right, the process will get me through today, and tomorrow, you know, something will have been figured out. And then by the time I'm halfway through, I think, okay, I have got to grips with this and more problems are just dropping on me, but that's all right because I've already got this number that I've sorted out in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. But I think with each book I feel imposter syndrome before I've got to a certain stage where I'm feeling comfortable in it. And I probably always will feel like that.
Mm. Yeah, and perhaps, yeah, if you stop feeling that, then maybe you're not writing on the edge of what you should be writing. You know, if you're too comfortable, then it probably will be boring for the reader.
Boring for the reader, and it'll bore you as well, which of course the reader will know. But yes, and the thing that keeps you interested is sometimes that little whiff of danger. Can I get away with this?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I was talking to another interviewee, Michael Ridpath, about when do you know a series is finished? And kind of we were both saying, well, it's when you don't want to write it anymore because you've got that, you can't get that feeling anymore. You're like, yeah, I don't want to spend my time writing another book like this. So yeah, I think this is really interesting. Okay, so let's just come on to marketing because you have the Nail Your Novel series, which is books for writers, and you've been on the show talking about that before. Very clear target market, authors, writers, and yeah, so it's easy enough to market that. You've got a blog, you market, you know, you talk to writers, you do events, etc. Then you've got your fiction, your literary fiction, which everyone knows is difficult to market.
Oh, yes.
So we're not talking about that. But with this memoir, how are you doing marketing for a memoir, which, I mean, you're not going to have a whole series of travel memoirs, I don't expect.
No, I don't think I travel enough.
No, exactly. Really. So this is kind of a standalone nonfiction in a new niche that you don't have any, you know. So anyway, so how are you marketing this book?
Well, what I did was I did a lot of research on Amazon. I looked up comparison titles. I sort of figured out what their categories were, tried to find outlets that were interested in covering that kind of book. It's a much easier kind of book to market, actually, than any of my fiction. I just kind of throw my hands up with my fiction thing. I just don't know what to do about it beyond a few kind of places. But with this, I just found I was getting more and more ideas. So travel magazines, walking magazines, anything to do with Britain. Mm. I found a website called Anglophilia, which just loves anything English, and that is quite an English book. So, I pitched them. They were really happy. I just found places that had covered books like this and said, I've got this coming out. It also helped that I did something I've never done before, which was I had a 2-month lead in before the publication date. It doesn't actually officially publish until the 2nd of October, but I started my marketing on the 1st of August. Mm. And I think you'd be proud of me.
Yeah, that's amazing. I never do that.
Usually I just push the book out of the nest and it's there already. But I'd found out from previous books, actually, that some of the magazines, the mainstream magazines, like a couple of months to figure out what they want to cover and get their books pages all sorted out well before the publication date. So I allowed myself enough time to actually have a good run up at those magazines, and that meant I had time to try quite a lot of them, do more in-depth research, and just target my marketing a bit more intelligently than I have in the past. But it is a title that is more easy to market than anything else I've written.
How interesting. Yeah, I guess because it is travel, like British travel memoir.
Yeah,
it does have quite an interesting niche. And did you, with your marketing hat on, I know that the writer and the marketer have to be different, but as you were writing, I can't remember, did you kind of scatter mentions of some of your novels within it?
What I did was I put a piece at the end called Westward, which is, it's all the places in case people want to visit them and where they can find them. But it's also how some of those places were prequels for what eventually ended up in my novels. Because by the time I'd finished massaging the pieces so they would make proper pieces for a book like this, I kind of learned quite a lot about the way I thought and the way ideas worked on me. And so I included a few paragraphs about how some of those travels had ended up in my novels, and also how there are some destinations that are going into Everest, which is the novel I'm working on at the moment. And um, I So I hoped that people who've enjoyed my writing style, for those who also like fiction, might also find their way to my fiction.
No, I think that's right. And because, as you say, your literary fiction is kind of standalone as well. So, you know, people might just try that, I guess. And on the publication of it, I remember a while ago you were looking into doing a special print edition that was similar to your visitor's book. What did you end up doing around the physical publication?
Well, I did go to Clay's and ask them about leather bound volumes, and I had a lovely meeting. I was showing all sorts of really lovely things, but the cost was prohibitive. I could maybe, if the sales of the original go really well, I could do something like a Kickstarter and try and get funding for a limited edition. I could possibly do that, but I figured I didn't have the time to do a proper campaign for that. And I know people who've done Kickstarters. You can't do any of this just by slapping a few things on a website and hoping it will work. You've really got to look at them properly. Any publisher would have people whose dedicated job was all this stuff, all and the marketing, any special editions, anything like that. They all have to be done properly. And I didn't want to do a shoddy job. So I shelved that, and I know what it would cost. So I know how I could do it. But what I did in the end was I just did my usual ebook version. I've got a lovely paperback. In fact, it's here. There's the front. There's the back.
Lovely.
And I've got that so far. And I'll just see how those go.
No, that's very cool. And and then I guess I've got to ask you, so have you got the taste for memoir? Are you going to do some more?
Dave would love me to do more. He keeps seeing other memoirs and saying, well, you could do one like that. And I think he suddenly thinks I might just hit a rich scene like Bill Bryson. I point out to him that it's about 20 years worth that went in that book. So he's going to have to do an awful lot of adventuring. I don't know. I did find myself writing another piece that I don't know if there will be another book yet, because I will need a lot of other pieces to go with it. But I do enjoy that kind of writing. I've sort of found a new groove that I just find rewarding. I like doing it. I probably won't stop writing like this, and maybe in a few years' time there'll be another. I don't know. I don't have specific plans, but I can see that it could get a bit wearing, but friends and family will say, oh, we don't want another adventure, thank you.
And what about with your nonfiction books? Because obviously you have Nail Your Novel and Edits and, you know, lots of different books for authors. What about Nail Your Memoir?
Well, that's an idea. A Nail Your Nonfiction was something I had thought of doing, because you know, I've not only written the Nail Your Novel books, but I've worked on a lot of nonfiction. And when I was running a publishing imprint, it was mainly nonfiction that we did. So I've seen a lot of nonfiction books through, from little germ of an idea to the finished book being printed on a ship on its way from China, all that stuff. So it could be something I'd do, but I find, like I was saying with the leather-bound version, to do anything like this, you actually have to have proper time. There's so many things that we could do. We've got to decide what we're going to spend our time on. And at the moment, the thing I've really got to try and nail is my third novel, because it really matters to me to get that out. So I'm hoping that will be the next thing, unless I get some big amazing project I suddenly get pulled into and think, well, I can't pass that up. But yes, we've only got, you know, finite amount of time and energy. That's the main problem.
It is, absolutely. So what can people find on your website, and where is your website, and where can people get your book?
Right. What's the easiest way? I've got absolutely loads of links all over the web. I'm on Twitter. So you can find me on Twitter at @Roz_Morris, and the Roz is R-O-Z. And do put the underline in, because there is another Roz Morris who gets a tweet to me all the time, and she hardly ever tweets herself, so she must sort of be having quite a weird experience. I'm also on Facebook. You can find me on my blog, which is Nail Your Novel, and that'll lead you to all the other places.
And the book is out?
The book is out on the 2nd of October, but you can pre-order it before then. And it's available in the ebook formats and a lovely paperback.
Fantastic. Oh, and are you considering reading it for an audio version? Because you have a lovely voice.
Oh, thank you. I am considering it. I have to brush up on my audio production skills because I did do some audio production on my course, my ghostwriting course, and I've now forgotten everything.
So. That's what studios are for.
Yes, well, that's another possibility.
Yeah, but I think it would definitely work as an audiobook as well with your voice. I think that would be really lovely. So the book is Not Quite Lost, Travels Without a Sense of Direction. And thanks so much for your time, Roz. That was great.
And thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Roz Morris, and definitely check out Not Quite Lost. Next week, I'm talking to Ricardo Fayette from Readzy about the top 5 mistakes of indie authors. Readzy is a fantastic marketplace for professionals, editors, cover designers, and marketing help. And Ricardo sees a lot of what authors are doing. He's well across the industry and speaks at a lot of events. And he's also an entrepreneur. So we talk about some of his tips for sort of building a business and, you know, how things get started. And you can find Readzy at thecreativepen.com/Readzy, R-E-E-D-S-Y. And yes, that's my affiliate link, or you can use readzy.com. So yeah, look forward to that interview next week. Happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.